This is William Thomas, and this is an interview with Raul Campos for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum Archive, The History of Financial Regulation. The date is April 13th, 2015, and we are in Washington, D.C. So thanks very much for agreeing to speak with us. Maybe we should start with a little bit of biographical background. I understand that you're from the very southernmost part of Texas and that you went to the Air Force Academy.
I did. I'm from a small town called Harlingen, Texas, which is about 30 miles north of the southernmost point in Texas. Brownsville, Texas is actually right where the Rio Grande River meets the Gulf of Mexico. This is about as far south as Miami. You know, a lot of people are amazed to hear that. And Harlingen is just a little bit north of that. And it's the only other claim to fame are, I guess, are two things. One, it was a former Air Force base site for NAV training, but that ended in the late 60s. And then it's on the way to South Padre Island, which is a spring break getaway for many people. And so they pass by Harlingen on the way to South Padre. So yeah, for those spring breakers who don't go to Florida, some go to South Padre Island. But yes, I grew up in Harlingen. I'm Mexican American. My parents, were working class people, and they spoke Spanish as their first language. Actually, has been in my area for literally hundreds of years. On my mother's side, we can trace ancestors back to 1590. 1590, of course, is well before the Pilgrims arrived. At that point in time, the Spanish colonists were there, and they were trying to secure the empire for Spain, given that there was competition from France in particular. And so the idea was they would give out land grants along the Rio Grande River that would have a narrow frontage of water on both sides of the river. Again, Rio Grande was not a border of any sorts, and they might have a mile on the river, and they go inland for 90 miles. But anyway, I went through elementary school and through high school and in Harlingen, and I applied to be an Air Force Academy cadet, in my junior year. And our congressman had a very simple approach. He would give people a civil service exam, and I fortunately scored the highest, and he offered me an appointment, and that was my ticket out of a small town and out of Texas, so I accepted.
Okay, you hadn't had any other military people in your family?
No, I did not. One person that influenced me a lot was a ninth grade teacher who was a retired lieutenant colonel in the Air Force, and so he pushed the Air Force Academy versus West Point or Annapolis, the Naval Academy. And, I was not exposed to a lot of things in terms of being in a busy city or other parts of the world, but the service academy and the Air Force in particular seemed attractive to me. I especially liked that they would it was a full tuition, obviously full scholarship, and being an officer in the Air Force was appealing to me. I at one point wanted to be a pilot.
Mm-hmm. And then after you finished at the academy, you went to and got an MBA at UCLA.
I did. During my four-year time at the Air Force Academy, my eyesight took a nosedive. I was qualified for pilot training when I went in, but I'm not totally sure. Maybe they just examined my eyes further, and they found a defect, at least under the system at that time. I think today you could use eye surgery, to probably pass these exams, but there wasn't anything like that available to me. So fortunately, I did well in my studies, and I got essentially selected to go into this program to get an MBA at UCLA. UCLA at that time had a program where they would give us credit for some of the courses, and so I was able to finish an MBA program in a year.
Okay.
So this was under my obligation. It didn't add to my Air Force obligation. So I finished, I graduated in 1971, and then I went directly to UCLA. I got married after I finished in September of the year, went to UCLA with my new bride, and attended the MBA program for about a year. And so that would have been 1972. And after that, I was assigned to the Boeing plant in Seattle, Washington, for my first assignment in the Air Force.
Okay. Could you tell me a little bit about what you did while you were in the Air Force?
Sure. Essentially, I was selected to go into what they called special weapons procurement. And the idea here, as one might gather, is that the services, in the Air Force in particular, are always in the procurement of high-tech weapons and other equipment that they need. So Boeing was a major contractor, still is today, with the Air Force and the other services as well. And at the time, Boeing was involved in the Minuteman missile program, you know, which is our intercontinental ballistic missiles, which still exist. And they had something called SHRAM, which was short-range attack missile. They built some of the cargo planes that the Air Force was using. So there was a lot of procurement going on. Some of the very first, what we call now drones, were being designed, you know, at Boeing at the time. This is 1972. And to give you a little perspective, this is Seattle before Microsoft. Okay, Bill Gates had not yet appeared. And, you know, programming as we know it today and software had not yet taken its shape and form. And it was right after, it was also before Starbucks, right? So those two major icons in Seattle had not yet occurred. Pike Market was a sleepy, provincial, you know, fishing dock area, you know, that was not gentrified at all, unlike today. Mercer Island, where Microsoft now dominates, you know, was a nice neighborhood in Seattle, but nothing much more to distinguish it other than, you know, beautiful shores and the lake and you know, water views. So my job, getting back to my job at the Boeing plant as an Air Force officer, was I was in charge of procurement and I was assigned to various programs. One program that I haven't mentioned that I did a lot on was called the AWACS, Airborne Warning and Control System. And what the AWACS was if you can imagine, a very large round radar on top of a Boeing 707. That was the original AWACS. And it, since then, it's progressed to a 747, you know, plane to be the mainstay, much larger. And, of course, the electronic systems have evolved substantially. But the idea and the mission of the AWACS, which still exists today, is to essentially provide an airborne control system of airplanes that were either attacking in a particular theater or coordinating other airplanes that might be involved in logistics and other type of missions like that. And there's even an AWACS system to enable the president and you know, the staff that he would have with him or her. We might have a woman president after all. To be in a place where they're actually above the ground and in an emergency type of situation to still have a command and control center and deal with the U.S. forces and other business of government. Again, this was a scenario in the Cold War where, you know, people could imagine that there would be an attack on the U.S. So that capability is still there, by the way. And so I worked on that particular program quite a bit.
Okay. And then you went to Harvard Law School after that.
Yes, what happened is two things in my personal life. One, my wife became a pre-med student and did very well at the University of Washington. And when she applied for medical school, she got into various medical schools. One of those was Harvard Medical. So I had a year to go in my Air Force obligation. So I asked, and the Air Force accommodated me, and I was reassigned to Hanscom Air Force Base and actually the MITRE labs, which are MIT research engineers labs outside of the Boston area, just outside the Loop 128 as we know it today. And my wife was able, we were able to stay together. She began her medical studies at Harvard Medical School. I put another year on the AWACS system and then resigned my commission. And I had applied to law school and got into Harvard Law. And I decided to do that. So I left the Air Force. I had to fulfill my obligation. I used the GI Bill to help pay for my law school. And you know, my wife and I were two students. We ended up living in Cambridge. She would go her way to Harvard Medical School, which is in the Roxbury area, and I would have the easier of it, and I could walk over to the law school.
Okay. So did you concentrate or intend to concentrate on any particular area of law, or were you just open-minded at that point?
I began with the idea of being a corporate and transactions lawyer, given that I had my majors at the Air Force Academy had been economics and engineering management, and then I had an MBA, mm-hmm. so it seemed a natural flow to go into business and business transactions. So I took corporate courses at the law school. I took one of the last courses in securities regulation taught by Louis Laws, mm-hmm. you know, the famous and well-known writer of the treatise that still exists today, and you know, has been kept up by Joel Seligman and then his protege, Troy Paredes. So that treatise still remains, you know, the sort of the go-to treatise in regulation of SEC regulation. So I did that, preparing, you know, for a sort of a corporate law career. But things don't always work out the way you planned. I took a job with Jones Day, Revis and Pogue, still a very large firm today. I think they just now dropped the other names and just called themselves Jones Day, and accepted their position in L.A., Los Angeles. Now, interestingly, you know, and I thought a lot about it, but I also had an offer as a as a law school graduate from the SEC, mm-hmm. and I could have worked in the general counsel's office with Ralph Ferrara, under his time as general counsel.
This is 1979 now, yeah.
Yeah, this is 1979, and I've often thought, who knows? You know, if I had done that, would I have ever been a commissioner? You know, I mean, it just life has a certain way of getting you where you're intended, I suppose. I've often thought that would have been a better choice, frankly, than going into the private sector, because I would have learned more. But I wasn't, I didn't analyze it that way. You know, maybe I wasn't, you know, clever and smart enough to have accepted that. It seemed like going to, a top-rate law firm was the way to go. So I made that choice. My wife agreed, and she did a residency in the Los Angeles area under a UCLA program at Harbor General, a large public hospital there in the Los Angeles area. And I went to work for Jones Day out of law school.
And so you were then mainly in the securities area, did I read it?
I started, yes. I started in the corporate area, as I had intended. And I don't know, this was 1979, 1980, going into 1980, just by the way of sort of letting people know where things were at that time. My starting salary at Jones Day was an impressive $24,000 a year. And when I showed up, they had increased it to be competitive with other law firms to $28,000, which was frankly enough. You know, I felt very, very well compensated in Los Angeles in 1979, 1980 at $28,000 a year. So interesting how times change. Today, just by comparison, a new associate at a major law firm coming out of law school is earning around $150,000. Some more. Some law firms pay more. So anyway, I started off in the corporate area. I worked with the corporate lawyers in the Jones Day office in Los Angeles. They were very good lawyers. But as time went on, we didn't have all the business that would keep an associate fully occupied. And as you may know, in law firms, as a new associate, you need to keep very busy, bill a lot of hours to satisfy demands on young lawyers. And I found myself of necessity taking assignments in litigation. And I found that I was, you know, pretty good at that. in particular because most litigation involved corporate or business matters, and many litigators in my time at Jones Day didn't have a business background, so they needed to do a little more study and work than I did in terms of understanding the issues. So that went on for a while, and after doing it for another year or so, I determined that, if I'm going to be a litigator and a business litigator, I might as well really learn how to be, a trial lawyer as well and have that full complement of skills. And the only way at the time and even today to get, hands-on trial experience is to go into either a prosecutor's shop or a public defender's situation. And I had friends and former Jones Day people at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Los Angeles. And, after inquiring, they invited me to apply. I applied, and I was very pleased to get an offer, from the local office of the U.S. Attorney, and decided that's what I would do next.
Okay, so this usually does turn up in your bio because of the cartel prosecutions and that sort of thing. How much depth would we like to go into here? Is there much else?
Well, I can give you a few highlights maybe, right. And then, we can always follow up if you find it interesting. So when I began, you're so-called rookie row, and so as a young prosecutor, whatever age you are, to get you trained, you accept in the U.S. Attorney's Office in L.A. what are generally smaller cases, and those tended to be in Los Angeles at the time bank robberies. Bank robberies were Los Angeles was known as the bank robbery capital of the world, essentially because there are a lot of branches and a lot of drug addicts need to go or decide to rob a branch, with a note, often not carrying any weapons, and they can escape quickly onto the freeways if they pick their branches correctly. So one reason or another, for those reasons, rather, L.A. has a lot of bank robberies. In other cities, the bank robbery is a very major crime and involves some of the most senior people. But I got my feet in terms of trial work by doing many bank robberies. And after that, you had a choice of what unit you went into. And we had, fraud units, which involved corporate fraud and government fraud and the like, other types of government fraud. And we also had a narcotics unit. And I quickly learned that if you wanted to get trial work, the place to go was narcotics. And the reason for that was, frankly, most of the cases that would be handled at the U.S. attorney level, not at the local level, had to do with cartel members, right? And so cartel cases, large distribution rings, essentially, were such where there wasn't much give in making a plea offer. In other words, there was no motivation if you ended up breaking a ring either through the FBI or DEA, Drug Enforcement Agency, or local authorities, to give these drug distributors and ringleaders much of a break. So, if they wanted a plea, you'd have to offer 20 years or more or something. And so in which case, that's prison time. They would say, well, let's go to trial. Maybe the prosecutor's team will make a mistake. So there were a lot of trials. And one of the trials I did involved a very striking incident involving a DEA agent who was stationed in Guadalajara, Mexico. At the time, the U.S. had DEA agents in various Latin American countries that were trying to help interdict and suppress the drug trafficking. And this agent, whose name was Enrique Camarena, C-A-M-A-R-E-N-A, was assigned to Guadalajara, as I said, Mexico. And he had the misfortune of doing a great job. He ended up discovering a very large narcotics cartel. Through a lot of persistence, he was able to get Mexican officials to fly over these thousands of acreage of fields where marijuana was grown and processed. and then taken onto trucks to the border. And also, the operation involved passing cocaine, you know, to the border. And in essentially breaking the ring, he forced, he urged the Mexican government to fly over these particular sites and drop chemicals on the on the crop and eradicate it essentially, and they rounded up many of the individuals involved. So you have to understand that this is a major multi-million dollar investment on the part of cartel ringleaders. They're essentially business people, right? Who happen to be in the drug business. And so this constituted loss of hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, when these fields were eradicated and cocaine was also confiscated, and their whole system under which much investment had been made was thwarted and disbanded. And keep in mind that you have to have power, you have to have trucks and large groups of people and cooking, you know, to provide food to the laborers. Anyway, all of that was disrupted. So they were very angry at the DEA and at this agent in particular. So sadly, on the last day of his assignment, he was, as he was walking out of the embassy, in the U.S. embassy in Guadalajara, two men came up to him, put a gun, you know, to his back, pushed him into a car, and that was the last he was ever seen. He was taken, we learned later, through evidence, to a mansion owned by one of the ringleaders, a fellow named Rafael Caro Quintero, and taken to a pool house behind there, interrogated, tortured, you know, to give information. It was recorded, and he was eventually killed through brutal beatings and trauma to the head. What came out of that, many interesting things came out of that. Of course, this was a terrible incident, and at one point, the U.S. Customs closed the border essentially by making sure that every car was inspected. Well, you can imagine the tie-ups and the long lines for miles of, you know, trucks and other commerce trying to get through the borders. And this was because Camarena had disappeared and his body had not turned up. As a result of this, the bad guys ended up exhuming his body and dumping it in a particular ranch, and that had its own complications. Eventually, FBI agents went and obtained forensics evidence. But just very quickly, one of the interesting aspects of this case was that there was this tape that was procured and in evidence, or at least in the government's possession, about the that had to do with the interview. It was a recording of the interview of the agent. And it became a huge challenge of how to get that particular tape into evidence. There was an informant that no one wanted to blow or to compromise, and so the chain of custody as to how that tape had been obtained couldn't be made. So it was a big challenge, and it fell on me to devise the legal theory of how to bring that into evidence. And I, you know, a good student that I was, I studied the evidence code, and I determined that there was a way to introduce it through self-authentication because the content was so unique and we could identify the agent's voice and the voice of several of the cartel members and let it in on its own weight of the evidence, right? Not the judge wouldn't declare it that it was authentic, but we would argue that it was, allowing the other side to argue against it if they could make a case that it had been fabricated in some way. So anyway, so this was a very publicized case. We ended up, I was part of a team, I was one of the co-prosecutors, and we ended up winning, in other words, convicting the three individuals, and there were many more who were involved, but these three were the only ones we had in custody at the time. And we ended up having them sentenced to 240 years. The death penalty at the time wasn't available. And it was a very dramatic trial. I was under U.S. Marshals protection because of a death threat at the time, and my family and I were being escorted by assistant U.S. attorneys, or I'm sorry, by deputy federal marshals home and back to the U.S. courthouse for a period of 6 months. So it was, you know, a lot of adrenaline was flowing in my body at the time. But fortunately, it all ended well. We weren't hurt, or we didn't have any incidents to report, but it was a very involved system of protecting me and my family, and even the L.A. County Sheriff's Department was involved in a potential rescue if my home at the time I lived in Glendale would have been attacked by narcotic hitman of some sort.
It's a very different story from what we usually get in these SEC Historical Society interviews.
I imagine.
Yes. So how long were you then with the U.S. Attorney's Office?
For about 5 years.
Okay.
And I left essentially just thinking that it wasn't fair to my family to keep giving them these kinds of adrenaline experiences. As much or as exciting as it was for me personally. So I left the U.S. Attorney's Office excuse me, and returned to private practice. I worked with I decided to do something different. I became a partner with a longtime Hollywood lawyer, well-known lawyer, who had represented Frank Sinatra, for example, for 33 years. It had been Frank Sinatra's do everything person. He had one of the best arrangements I think a lawyer ever had with a client. He would take 10% off the top of everything Frank Sinatra made, and he would book him in Las Vegas, deal with the studios in terms of any movies along the way. This particular partner, whose name was Mickey Rudin, ended up also establishing record companies, which became Warner Records and other evolutions since then, on behalf of Frank Sinatra, who maintained ownership. So it was quite a very interesting, set of assignments. And I at that time, I wanted to keep doing trial work, courtroom work if necessary, but also do some go back to doing some business transactions. So I did that for a few years, and it went well. I was I had a good practice in Beverly Hills, and then I did something very, very different. Again, you gather that I'm not I haven't had the typical career. I chose to accept the invitation of a client of mine, who at that moment was raising capital and building a company to own radio stations. And his business premise, I felt, was very strong. The idea was that the radio industry at that moment in time, and we're talking now early 90s, was still not consolidated. And it's not the radio industry that exists today. Many radio stations in major cities were owned by private individuals. So you might have in LA, several radio stations owned by a large car dealer, for example. Gene Autry, former star and singing cowboy, owned various very strong, very well-known radio stations, for example, in Orange County and in the LA area. In other cities, you had funeral directors, for example, owning radio stations. So it was sort of the local businessman's media, that mm-hmm. they would buy and find it interesting. Some of these individuals would actually even be on-air personalities. They would do stuff at lunchtime. I remember one director who would come on lunchtime for an hour and play his guitar and sing, and he wasn't considered to be very good. So the idea was that was twofold. One was that we would have consolidation in the industry, and essentially that we would end up having a change of laws. The laws at that time only allowed a large company, to own two major signals in a city. And so, therefore, it was called a duopoly world, and that allowed these smaller businesses and individuals to own radio stations.
Those are FCC rules?
FCC, with a, like Frank, right. CC. We were thinking that there might be deregulation of the industry, much like the airlines and so forth, and that was Gingrich in that particular Congress working on that.
Right.
There were other industries like the airline industry that were also looking at being deregulated. So we thought, we had this great idea, that if we could grab these stations at the current prices, then their price might jump up in the future if deregulation did indeed occur, you know, by Congress. And we also thought that we could provide a manner and a system of management of these radio stations, take it away from kind of a frills and a hobby approach that these local people did. So anyway, we went out and raised capital, bought radio stations. It still required a lot of capital to buy a major signal in a city like L.A., you know, it was many, many millions of dollars. So we brought in investors like Goldman Sachs and others. And I did that for about 5 years, more like 7 years. And we built a company. We had major investors. Goldman became our major investor over time. And I ended up in Houston, Texas, essentially because we were able to make more deals in Houston and in Texas than we were anywhere else. And so most of our properties ended up being there.
Right.
So we ran our course. You know, we were entrepreneurs. And
and this is El Dorado Communications.
Yes. The company was called El Dorado Communications. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I was one of the owners, founders. I wore many hats, general counsel. I also was a general manager for a while of our operation in Houston. And it came to the point where our investors wanted us to sell our properties and return money at a major profit to them instead of just keep building. We had harbored the idea and had thought that we might continue to build our company into a major radio owner and operator. But you know, your investors, you know, control those kind of strategic plans, and they wanted us to sell. So we did.
And the deregulation had taken place during this period?
It did.
Yeah. This is when
it did. So our prices, which was another temptation, our prices jumped way high. And so we bought stations, for example, at $20 million that were now worth $100 million or $120 million. You know? So we had big profit margins that, again, our investors wanted to cash in on. So that's what you do when you're in that type of world. We had kept a little ownership. So we sold. We made a little money for ourselves, not as much as we'd hoped, but you know, we did okay. And as far as my situation went, an interesting turn of events occurred. I was asked by people that were very active in the Democratic Party whether I would consider being an SEC commissioner. At the time, Tom Daschle was the Senate majority leader for the Democrats. And actually, he was the leader of the minority. The Democrats were in the minority. As 2002 came in and George W. Bush was elected president, so the Republicans had the control. And I found it intriguing, and you know, after discussions with them, they pointed out that well, I would be a different type of commissioner in terms of my background. Mm-hmm. You know, I hadn't devoted my life exclusively to SEC regulation, which was a concern of mine. I said, well, you know, do you think this is something that would make sense?
And had you been active in the party, or how did they come to select you to?
I had not been particularly active. I was a Democrat. I registered as a Democrat. I'd given to some Democratic candidates, but being in business, I had also given to Republican candidates. I think they chose me because they my particular sponsor liked me and thought I would bring an interesting set of background and experiences to the SEC. And anyway, he persuaded Tom Daschle to interview me, who was having to make that decision. And I interviewed with him and his chief of staff, who at the time was a fellow named Pete Rouse. And there were other very qualified people. And they decided that I was going to be their choice, you know. And so it was a bit of a surprise to me. So in speaking it over with my family, they decided it was a good opportunity. I had, at that time, I was looking at finding another business opportunity, taking my my winnings in terms of our return for the investment we had had in El Dorado into another business, or possibly going back into law practice. And but being a commissioner sounded interesting. I thought it'd be, an interesting opportunity. So I accepted, their offer. I was vetted by, the White House, the George W. Bush White House at the time, and eventually nominated, to be a commissioner. And it was an interesting point in time because we had had the Enron situation and Enron WorldCom. So we had this sudden explosion of essentially fictitious numbers on financial returns that were for public companies. Mm-hmm. And that was, I think, another reason that they found me attractive, given my prosecutorial background. Suddenly the SEC was going to be in a situation unlike other eras where it was going to be busily enforcing fraud problems, fraud issues. So Enron was there, and then suddenly WorldCom also became an issue shortly thereafter. You had Adelphia and many
all others. Very prominent cases as well, being
right
at the spotlight.
Exactly, yeah. Right. And so, hey, someone who's been a prosecutor, businessman, corporate lawyer at one point in his life, and a military officer, seemed interesting. And I know that the Bush White House had no issues with me. They thought I was very qualified. So anyway, my confirmation went smoothly. I met many of the senators beforehand, including Phil Graham, and it all went very well. And so I was confirmed for my nomination in August of 2002, on the same day as Sarbanes-Oxley was passed, So I'm a brother of Sarbanes-Oxley, or son of.
So when you got there, actually, this was almost an entirely new commission. I think Harvey Pitt had been there for about a year, and then there were a couple of other people coming in more or less within months of you. Could you tell me a little bit about that dynamic?
Yes. So Harvey Pitt, who's a friend of mine today, had been appointed chair early in the as the George W. Bush administration took over, and Harvey Pitt was, of course, a well known litigator, SEC regulatory expert, and was a lawyer, had been a lawyer at Fried Frank, where he had a very preeminent practice in securities regulation. So he was a chair, and for a moment in time after he took over, I think there were only two other commissioners, if memory serves me right. You had Cindy Klassman, who was nominated, but she had not yet been appointed. And so I think she was serving nonetheless actively on the commission. She ended up being confirmed at the same time that I did, but she had already begun at the as a commissioner. And you had I need to pause here. An African American commissioner,
Isaac Hunt.
Yes, yes, Isaac Hunt, who was also on the and his term had expired, but was on. Sort of a tail situation, which happens to commissioners. They don't always have to leave immediately when their term ends. Often, they can continue to serve until Congress adjourns for the congressional term. So Isaac Hunt, a very fine individual, whom I met later, was one of the commissioners at the time. And so I think one of the things that Congress wanted to do. And this was a different era. There was a lot of mutual work and compromise in putting Sarbanes-Oxley together, i.e. the name Sarbanes, Senator Sarbanes, and Mike Oxley, the leader of the House at that time, put together this bill that was dubbed Sarbanes-Oxley. And this was in response, as you know, to the you know, to these huge frauds that suddenly erupted and upset the public very, very much, you know, given the losses that many people took with Enron and then later with WorldCom. Suddenly, you know, the stock markets and owning public company stocks seemed to be a hazardous thing. And so there was a big desire to calm the waters and make the world seem safe again for investors in public company stock. So I was nominated along with Harvey Goldschmidt. We were both Democratic nominees. And on the Republican side, and this was done together so that there would be balance, and neither the Republicans nor the Democrats would pick on the opposite party's nominees. And on the opposite side, on the that were also being confirmed at the same moment, were Paul Atkins, an individual who had served at the SEC in prior times, had been at PwC, and very experienced fellow and very capable, and Sidney Glassman. So it was kind of this maybe began the idea of having both the Democratic nominees and the Republican nominees for the SEC be confirmed together, sort of as a package. That way, nobody would sit on the others, and it was deemed very important to put all of us on. And confirmed on the commission, rather than having a commission that was
temporarily out of balance.
Yes, out of balance and had vacant spots. This gave the full complement and allowed the commission to work as intended, statutorily. And the idea here, just to maybe say the obvious, is that the commission works with five commissioners. One is the chair. The chair is appointed by the president's party, usually with a lot to say by the president and his immediate staff, and two others when their nominations come up. So the idea is that the president's party appoints three of the serving commissioners, right? So they have a majority of the five. The other two, are nominated by the party that doesn't have the presidency. So in my time, obviously, I was serving under George W. Bush, a Republican. So I was a minority in terms of the two Democrats, initially with Harvey Goldschmidt and myself. Later, Harvey returned to academics. He was a law professor, well-known law professor at Columbia. And Annette Nazareth took his place while I was serving. And the three commissioners initially that were Republican were, of course, Harvey Pitt, the chair, Paul Atkins, and Sidney Glassman.
Right. So you arrived there, and you pretty much immediately fell into the problems surrounding the nomination for the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board. I know that you gave a speech in support of John Biggs, and then there was the events that ultimately led to Harvey Pitt having to resign. Could you tell me a little bit about what it was like to just kind of walk into that situation, your own perception of what was going on?
Yes, it was an unfortunate situation, just to put that out there. Sarbanes-Oxley, for a little background, one of the signature items of Sarbanes-Oxley was that the act established a new government entity. It's not quite an agency. And this is what's called the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board. So essentially, Congress, through the Act, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, determined that the accounting profession and the auditors in particular of public companies needed oversight. And this is because the accountants and the auditors at Enron and at WorldCom had totally missed these frauds. And in reviewing the situation, these cases indicated that there had been some sort of lax behavior on the part of the auditors, the public company auditors, and that there had been some lack of diligence in some respects. Now, all that's controversial, I think some would argue today that that frauds are very difficult to unravel or to discover, and that the mistakes made were mistakes that could be made at any time. Nonetheless, Congress felt that the public needed some reassurance. And the industry, the audit industry, was essentially at a low point in terms of its reputation with the public. So the PCAOB was intended to bring up the level of practice and to assure that the right practices were followed and that indeed investors could rely on the annual reports and the financials that were being audited mm-hmm. by certified auditors and that these had a level of diligence and reliability. And the PCAOB, the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, would make sure by examining the auditors, examining what they did. This was the idea for the board. Mm-hmm. And it was going to be built from scratch. A staff had to be hired. Board members had to be appointed. And the
and there was a very short time frame on getting all this set up,
yes.
too, if I recall.
Right. Exactly right. Congress gave the SEC that I was on, the commission, a very short period to implement Sarbanes-Oxley. We had very tight deadlines, and we took them very seriously. And our chairman, Harvey Pitt, pushed very hard, the staff pushed very hard, the commission, quite appropriately, to implement, to get the rules out that were involved. And so we were facing a short time period in getting the PCAOB established. And remember, just a little bit more background, Arthur Andersen had been a very famous, very well-known, with a high reputation audit firm that happened to be the firm that was auditing Enron when Enron unraveled. And so Enron, of course, ultimately had to declare bankruptcy. Arthur Andersen became an item of scrutiny, mm-hmm. and some of its auditors who were involved in the Enron were essentially prosecuted. One auditor, in fact, pleaded guilty. And so what was involved was Arthur Andersen facing a criminal conviction as a corporate entity. Mm-hmm. And so that essentially destroyed its ability to continue. An audit firm mm-hmm. with a conviction would no longer have its reputation sufficient to attract clients. And so Arthur Andersen unraveled, and again, that was not a great moment in our financial history, because a lot of people put out work. There are many people who are innocent within Arthur Andersen who suffered retirement plans and so forth, had to be abandoned given the bankruptcy unwinding and all that sort of thing. So a lot of chaos going on. So one of the things we had to do was not only appoint members, but also appoint the chair, right? And we undertook a process where we interviewed different nominees for board membership, as well as potential chairs. Mm-hmm. And at one point, the commission, with Harvey in agreement, Harvey Pitt in agreement, had agreed on John Biggs as that's my recollection, as the choice, and everything was going to be fine. So I thought, non-controversial. We were going to have a clear endorsement and a nomination by acclamation, essentially. Somewhere along the way, that changed, and Harvey Pitt decided to go with Judge Webster, who had been, of course, a federal judge, and he had been appointed at one point as head of the FBI. A very, very high-profile, well-regarded, personality and individual. What I personally determined was that when that occurred, it was a mm-hmm. surprise to me. I did not have a discussion with any of the other commissioners about the change and the pivot to Judge Webster, And I don't know how that happened, you know, even now looking back on it. And I've had the opportunity to talk to Harvey Pitt about it, but you know, it's a delicate area that I've never really asked for clarification. But I found myself in New York, you know, doing a commitment that I had made, open commission meeting had been scheduled, and suddenly I'm becoming aware that Judge Webster is going to be the nominee and being supported by Harvey Pitt and the two Republican commissioners. So I had already made a commitment to John Biggs, to John Biggs, because I felt he had the financial, the broader corporate background, and I felt that we didn't need a strictly law and order, you know, background person, which I felt was the background that Judge Webster brought. Now, you know, that didn't disqualify him, but I just felt that John Biggs at the time, who was the chair of TIA CREF, you know, was more appropriate given the moment, given what was needed, and his understanding of corporate matters, business, and auditing. Mm-hmm. So I found myself in an awkward situation.
He'd also been appointed a public representative of FASB, I think.
Yes.
As well.
You're right. So that was another item of his qualifications that I found very, very strong. And what may have happened, is that there was a leak earlier, that a few days before our meeting in which we were to make the decision, that John Biggs was going to be the choice. And there was commentary by some of some political people that, it's too bad that, you know, it couldn't, you know, there couldn't be a Republican. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so many Republicans who are qualified. Well, you know, it was, you know, I never intended, and I don't think other commissioners necessarily intended that this be a political, you know, decision. You know, yes, Biggs was a Democrat, but that was, you know, he wasn't an active Democrat in terms of being a political person. You know? He was not a fundraiser, not served any particular administration, and that sort of thing. And I don't know if that influenced, you know, my colleagues on the Republican side to then leave the decision we had earlier made, or understanding we had, to support Biggs into then going and supporting Judge Webster. No one came to me in advance and discussed it with me and tried to persuade me that Judge Webster was indeed the right choice. So I found myself at this open meeting, you know, in an awkward situation, I knew that Harvey Goldschmidt also felt very strongly about John Biggs, and so I determined to prepare, you know, my statement in support of Biggs. Harvey Goldschmidt decided to do that as well, and so we gave our, every commissioner went down and gave their reasons. And again, it was hugely awkward, unfortunate, because, you know, you don't discuss people's qualifications in public, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, when you're hiring, you're making a major hire, these are things that, you know, should be kept in private, because it's usually not about, it's about subtleties, you know. Mm-hmm. Again, one set of qualifications versus another, it's a judgment as to which one is better. So anyway, that's what transpired. You know, there was 3-2 votes.
Right.
You know, the three Republican commissioners with Chairman Pitt voted 3-2 against us, and Judge Webster was indeed voted as the chair. Now, what I did was I let it be known that I would, I had talked to Judge Webster, I think, in advance of the meeting, and told him, look, obviously I admire you. I think you're an icon, and you're one of the people that I respected. I'm also, you know, obviously in law enforcement and have been a federal prosecutor. So I totally appreciate where you're coming from. Nonetheless, I said to him, I'm in a position where I feel your qualifications. I mean, you should, be in another position, to utilize your expertise, and not this one. This was a very dangerous one in terms of corporate, mm-hmm. the corporate world, fraud, auditing. Without having a substantial background there, I just don't think you're ideal. Not that you couldn't do the job, you couldn't learn it. And given that we have John Biggs, I told him, if my colleagues vote you in, I will support you in every way possible. And in fact, when that happened, I wrote him afterwards. I congratulated him and told him he could count on my support going forward. And I think we even made plans to meet further and discuss how I could be helpful in any way he thought in transitioning into his job. So that's what occurred. The press, ran with it and thought it was, a bit of a sensational story, mm-hmm. and went forward with it. Sadly, a few days after that, it was determined, or it was revealed. I don't know if the press did it or how exactly it was, but that Judge Webster had served on a board of a company whose chair and CEO was being investigated, mm-hmm. for some type of fraud, and that fact had not been disclosed to the entire commission. Apparently it was, again, I learned this third hand, it was known or should have been known, by the chief accountant at the time, who was aiding Chairman Pitt. And I don't know if it was just a mistake or what exactly, why this bit of information wasn't shared with the rest of the commission. But at that point, I think, two things happened. Judge Webster resigned, his appointment, given that was indeed embarrassing and an item that, was not known to the commission. And Harvey followed up by offering his resignation, Harvey Pitt, to the president. And, there had been a series of things that had happened under Harvey's watch that had brought him bad press. Mm-hmm. All things that, that maybe under other circumstances would not have been items to cause a resignation, but, had added up. And so, the president accepted his resignation, which, again, was an unfortunate situation all around. The commission didn't look good. Harvey was immensely qualified. He was probably one of the best qualified chairs ever in the commission's history. And it was, I still think it's mm-hmm. a shame, and I regret it. It didn't work out, and the commission didn't have a way of benefiting from Harvey Pitt's immense background and experience.
So let's talk a little bit about the implementation of Sarbanes-Oxley then. I know you spoke about it a little bit, but were there any particular areas or rules that proved particularly difficult or notable that you recall?
Sarbanes-Oxley, was by comparison to Dodd-Frank, mm-hmm. It was very small, and maybe today we would even use the word quaint. But it had very significant items, and I'm glad to say that today the items of Sarbanes-Oxley have become, almost part of the DNA of corporate governance, of auditing and so forth. So implementing and selecting the board chair of the PCAOB and the other board members was a major task. We had to do that. And that involved discussions among ourselves and voting and so forth, and I think we got a pretty good representation, and mm-hmm. You needed some accounting expertise, but the thought was that and Congress had baked this in that the accountants not overwhelm the board, right? So it wouldn't be viewed as an industry association at some point. And so we did that, and ultimately Bob McDonough, you know, who had been a Fed Reserve chair at New York, Fed Reserve head of the New York Bank of the Fed Reserve, was appointed, and he did a very commendable job as chair of the PCAOB, as his first chair after Judge Webster. And so that was difficult, and it involved its own sort of politicking and finessing. Mm-hmm. Sarbanes-Oxley, let's see if I can break it down, involved some governance rules, essentially the idea of independent board committees, mm-hmm. and the independent audit committee of the board of directors of public companies being in charge of the relationship with auditors, not by management. It had been the practice in the past that management would select the outside auditors. So there was this natural, my boss and who I have to please is the manager, the CEO, the CFO, and that group. And the idea was to break that and, you know, for the most part, make sure that the auditors understood that it was instead the board of directors through its audit committee that controlled the relationship. Obviously, they worked with the management team. That was never intended to go away, but that they understood that there was an independence there that was involved. So that was interesting, and that involved, you know, a lot of lobbying. I think many corporate interests were worried about losing the ability to select the outside auditors, but that was the law, and they all came to live with it. You know, we had to do and meet with many corporate groups of public companies and reassure them that, you know, we weren't looking to displace them, but instead, mm-hmm. you know, create better governance. There were limitations on loans to executives, you know, that Sarbanes-Oxley provided, and that went pretty smoothly. It wasn't too terribly difficult to work that out, because I think their, you know, CEOs understood, you know, the value and the appearances, the bad appearances that could cause if they were getting so-called sweetheart loans from the company, or if the public might view them that way. The other independent committees were established, nominations, for example, compensation, you know, and all of that became part of what exists today, you know, and I'm very happy to see that it's been, it's part of good governance today. The majority, you know, and we did this through influencing the NYSE and the NASDAQ to have listing requirements that establish the independence of directors. Mm-hmm. And so the rule is that you have to have a majority of independent directors now in public companies. And so that's fully established. One of the audit rules caused a lot of problems and required you know, several iterations, and that was Rule 404,
right.
404B. And it's a very technical item, but let me just summarize it. Essentially, the rule required that management at some point of a public company set up internal controls, and they had to document the internal controls. The idea here being is that a public company has its own set of finances and risks, mm-hmm. and the internal controls systems need to be, you know, very defined, you know, thought about carefully, revised as appropriate, and documented. And in this way, a company would provide more comfort to investors and not be likely to go off the rails, as it were, you know, and having both the board and existing managerial staff, in particular in the accounting and finance area, have controls that, again, gave reliability, hopefully, certainly provided more reliability to the numbers that were being produced. And then the auditors were supposed to audit at some point. There was a period of time, the internal controls, right? And the internal and the auditor's effort is what caused initially a big brouhaha, because it necessitated, it was a new work, and it expanded the scope of work of the auditors, and so there were new costs involved in the management group providing the new 404 internal controls, and thereafter having the auditors confirm that those particular controls and the management job had been done. Additional audit work, which then increased the audit costs, right? So at least for for 1 year, it was a big issue because it was additional cost, and you know, and the corporate community of public companies, the Business Roundtable and others, squawked mightily about it. It was an issue for them for about a year and a half. You know, once they did it, once internal controls and the documentation, which was costly internally, you know, they had to expend resources to do these documentations, which weren't done in many large companies. You can imagine a large company, you know, that has foreign operations, all the different procedures and internal controls that would have to be in place. But once that got done, they became less concerned. However, the smaller issuer community that was mostly domestic continued to lobby and continued to get extensions on their compliance with 404B. The argument being that, you know, you're discouraging small companies from becoming public because this is an additional expense that doesn't inure to, it doesn't necessarily produce a better bottom line, and it's not going to produce better returns to investors. So therefore, you're discouraging companies, essentially, small companies in particular, new companies, from becoming public. And therefore, you're reducing the IPOs, which is, you know, not a good thing overall in the financial community. So the SEC continued to extend the time, and they have now decided, I haven't visited this area in a while, but they have now decided, as I understand, to give exemptions for smaller issuers from the full 404B, and there are certain elements of that. So that, you know, that occupied a lot of my speeches and time immediately for the first 2 years or so of, you know, of implementing Sarbanes-Oxley. So that was one area that did take that was fought very strenuously.
I wanted to ask very generally, Graham Leach Bliley had been passed in 1999, I believe. Were there still jurisdictional questions being worked out at this time as to how the SEC would operate within that versus, you know, the Fed, the FDIC, OCC, and some of the bank regulatory organizations, or was that not something that came up?
Yeah, that was a major issue. Yeah. And, you know, the staff felt very strongly that they didn't want to cede, you know, any authority to the other regulators, and not for bad purposes, you know, not for obstinance or anything, but the idea of the regulatory agencies like the SEC, like the Securities Exchange Commission, is that an expertise had developed and was developing and maintained in the areas that the SEC touched and oversaw. And the idea of letting securities activities within a bank go to the Fed or FDIC or the other bank regulators seemed to us to be an abandonment of the intent of Congress, you know, through the 33-34 acts and so forth. And so even today, a lot of the jurisdictional areas and overlaps of securities work inside a traditional bank, and that's what is a traditional bank has blurred, right? Because of the 08 crisis, subject for another day. But during my time, we had five or so independent broker dealers, you know, independent investment banks, right? And these investment banks did not take deposits. They used their own capital, and they underwrote securities offerings and did mergers and acquisitions, and you know, and maintained securities accounts, right? They traded in bonds and all of that. So now they have all become banks because they've all accepted the Fed window option to provide cheap loan, cheap money, almost at no cost, you know, with the zero interest rates that have been prevailing. And so there are no longer any independent investment banks, broker-dealers. They're all part of a bank organization, which is also subject to bank jurisdiction, right? Either the Fed, if it's structured under a bank holding company, or the FDIC, you know, for those others, and even the OCC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. So these are fights and discussions that continue today. We have further complications with FSOC, you know, which is a strange animal that Dodd-Frank created. It's not exactly an agency, but it's an entity in which all of the major regulators, chaired by Treasury, part of the executive branch of the federal government, the Secretary of Treasury, in fact, is the chair, bring the chairs of all of these other agencies, and there's other members. It's a complicated formula as to who sits on there. But all the idea here is to be able to assess where there are large systemic risks to the entire financial system. And roughly $50 billion, you know, of assets under management has been the rough threshold. That's been changing, you know. It depends on, you know, I'm not as up to date as I might be, but you know, questions such as should insurance companies, you know, be viewed as systemically risky, right? And those questions exist today, and the lines of SEC securities regulation in terms of a broker dealer inside a bank, you know, versus the Fed requirements and versus reserves that are required are all areas that are still very active and being debated. And you know, I think the SEC continues to maintain that its jurisdictional rights there.
Is there a particular time at which we have to break off?
I thought that we agreed, you know, with till about 3 o'clock, you know, given a further extension.
All right.
You know, I think the people that have been coming in here are our cleanup staff that maybe just were probably didn't get the word, and they were thinking that they needed to you know, clean up our code.
I just wanted to see if we had to do a smush a lot of stuff into about 20 minutes, but it's only 2 o'clock right now.
Yeah, I think so. If you don't mind, I'll just quickly check. See if there's any more on my email.
Okay, so maybe we should talk a little bit about enforcement strategy. Of course, there was a lot of public pressure at this time to clean up all the various messes and to ensure that they would not recur. I'm wondering about some of the discussions within the commission among the staff. You know, you have to, of course, bring cases that you have a hope of winning and so forth. What was that like? Was there agreement? Was there disagreement on these issues?
So enforcement was an area that, of course, I had a lot of background in. And so I brought my experience in enforcement through federal prosecution. You know, I may have been the first former assistant United States attorney, you know, who had been a federal prosecutor to serve as a commissioner. So I think the commission felt obligated to restore trust in the system, as it were. Say 02, and I served from 02 to 07, but in particular, you know, based on the scandals that we had just been involved in, which were Enron, WorldCom, Adelphi, and others, and those frauds were simple by today's standards. They simply were making up numbers, essentially, you know, if I can put it that way. and these fictitious returns on financial statements led to very bad consequences. Companies had to go out of business, investors lost money, and they wondered whether other companies were doing the same thing. So I believe it was appropriate when fraud was discovered and there was actually an effort to defraud shareholders and invent numbers, as it were, to the benefit of managers or senior executives, that those people, those folks, if there was a case there, should be punished appropriately. Now, remember, the SEC only has civil authority, right? So it is not a criminal agency. So the cases that the SEC brings are civil lawsuits. So the SEC, in filing an enforcement action, would file a civil lawsuit, typically, if it hadn't been settled, or even if it was settled, it's with a federal complaint alleging wrongdoing and violation of SEC rules, some type of fraud was committed, and the idea would be to extract there are various types of penalties and sanctions, disgorgement of unlawful profits, for example, if they were in the company or individuals were part of what was looked at. And I felt very strongly that in these cases of fraud, you should extract as much as possible of any wrongful gains, right? And the idea that that you also needed deterrence, a penalty on top of that, sometimes was appropriate, just to show that there wasn't a way of going forward. Do you want to just stop it for a second?
Sure. Okay.
So we were talking about enforcement actions. What I found as time went on was that Harvey Goldschmidt and I usually agreed on the deterrence and the penalties and the sanctions. And remember, what we have in front of us are cases that the staff is bringing, right, for approval. And we would often see eye to eye on these items. And by the way, I would not discuss this in advance with Harvey Goldschmidt. It just turned out that we had similar views. And after Harvey Pitt, the first chair, left, Bill Donaldson became the chair. And I found that Bill Donaldson also tended to agree, with the presentations that the staff were making. In particular, when we had questions and we wanted to adjust or even ask for more, which we sometimes did, more in sanctions to increase the deterrence and make it appropriate based on the severity of the fraud, that Bill Donaldson agreed as well. Often, as it turned out, there was disagreement, on our between us and among all of the commissioners and the two other Republican commissioners, Paul Atkins and Sidney Glassman, would not always, but would mm-hmm. sometimes feel differently, and that the penalties and the sanctions might be a little lighter, to accomplish the same things. They had good intentions. They were just coming from a place that was different, at times. And they often agreed with us. We often had unanimity, but at times there was a difference of opinions.
I noticed in certain cases that Chairman Donaldson did tend to agree with you and Harvey Goldschmidt. I think over mutual fund governance as well, which I wanted to bring up a little bit later. But
yeah. Well, see, in that situation, yeah. we're out of enforcement mm-hmm. cases into rulemaking, mm-hmm. which would be new rules involving different industries, right? So the SEC, besides bringing enforcement actions, also does rulemakings mm-hmm. to, like Sarbanes-Oxley, it was implemented through a rulemaking. And these rules become essentially law, statutory law, that is followed by the affected industries. So the SEC, for example, has jurisdiction directly over broker-dealers, which it exercises through FINRA. And in the Advisors Act, and it has jurisdiction over mutual funds, which it exercises through the Investment Company Act and through its through one of its divisions called Investment Management. So in that situation, we had a proposal from the staff, and the staff at IM Investment Management had come, after much study, had come to believe that investment companies, which are mutual funds, have their own boards, right? And it's an odd creature in terms of these investment companies because you have an advisor, right? An investment advisor create a mutual fund and often appoint the boards themselves. So it's a little bit of incestuous in one respect. And the idea is that the board then is supposed to oversee the advisor and make sure that the advisor performs adequately for mm-hmm. the mutual fund investors, you know, that end up buying shares of the mutual fund, and that the fee, in particular the mutual fund, the advisor fee rather, is appropriate, right? And often what was occurring in the practice at the time was that the advisor's executive, usually its chief executive, would also become chair of the board. So we believe that that was contradictory to good governance, right?
Did the staff produce this before or after the scandals that broke, I think, in 2003? Because I know it had been discussed even under Chairman Leavitt, so I know that the discussions right. at least date back that far.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so there had been work done and studies and surveys and efforts that had been done over the years, including others, as you say, other chairs and other administrations, obviously, under Clinton. And so what had occurred is, I don't recall exactly, but we had it... an unusual scandal in the mutual fund world having to do with timing. Mm-hmm. And there, what was occurring was that certain investors were allowed to buy or sell after the 4 p.m. closing, which essentially gave them the benefit of knowing what the closing price was going to be, which mm-hmm. is not supposed to happen. So this occurred among some mutual funds. And then there was also what we call the other timing involved foreign companies using the time zone differences to be able to make investments again at a point that where they could see what the closing price was going to be, giving them certain advantages. So these scandals occurred, and we had enforcement actions against mutual funds and their advisors at that point. And I that may have influenced the staff to propose this particular rule change, which was that an executive of the advisor could not be the chair of the board, or in other words, that the board chairman needed to be independent of the advisory company that gave the recommendations and made the decisions as to what stocks to invest in. So, you know, it made sense to me after listening to the staff, after evaluating the situation. But this was another divisive item. You know, the two Republican commissioners that weren't the chair, Paul Atkins and Cindy Glassman, disagreed mm-hmm. very strongly. They supported some industry groups, which included Fidelity and its chair, Ned Johnson, who just didn't see that as a necessary item. Mm-hmm. So we voted, and in this particular case, the chairman, you know, Bill Donaldson, who, again, oversaw the staff, agreed with Harvey Goldschmidt and me, And we three passed that particular rulemaking. Mm-hmm. Now, that was challenged, and, you know, the D.C. Circuit ruled on administrative basis that the SEC had not gone through enough process mm-hmm. and developed its administrative record sufficiently.
You know, this had to do with cost-benefit analysis?
Yeah, the cost-benefit
yeah.
analysis, exactly.
Was this kind of a new strategy that was being used in challenging the SEC?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. There had always been a requirement to do mm-hmm. a cost-benefit analysis. The problem with cost-benefit analysis in the main, from my perspective, is that it's always easy to see costs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very difficult to quantify benefits,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, how do you? What's the benefit, for example, and how do you quantify it, of better governance,
mm-hmm.
you know, of independence, things that are clearly are good, but can you say that a certain amount of money was not lost or mm-hmm. that the company made more money? Very difficult. So it's a concept that is good in theory, but using that as sort of the bulwark and the leverage, there was a particular D.C. Circuit judge named Ginsburg who, you know, is a former economist or certainly did economic study, and he very strongly believed in a very robust cost-benefit analysis. And, you know, frankly, he didn't believe, you know, that had been done. He may just have disagreed as well, you know, with the rule. That sometimes happens, you know, with judges. And, you know, they find a way to justify their own views in this particular era. But the truth, you know, in terms of what I could see, is that the staff had done a lot of work, mm-hmm. you know, and it was not done, you know, haphazardly. You know, a lot of study had been done, and there is a concept called the Chevron concept, which essentially, Chevron being a case that occurred, in which the agency is given deference for expertise. That never was given, you know, in that challenge and in that decision by the D.C. Circuit. That decision was overturned, and the decision was made not to appeal it, I believe. And so now the interesting thing is that the industry has, on its own,
mm-hmm.
essentially now deemed it to be good practice not to have an executive of the advisor be the chair of the board. And they have gone to self police and to adopt voluntarily this practice, where today, if it's not a majority, it's close to a majority of mutual funds subscribe to the notion and to the concept that their chair and the other board members should be independent and not be an employee or an executive of the advisor.
On the themes of self-governance and the independence. Could we talk a little bit about the SROs and some of the issues that were going on there around the same time?
Sure.
Particularly with the New York Stock Exchange.
Sure. Do you want to give me a little flavor of what you're looking for?
Yeah, well, basically the events, there is, in the very specific case, there's the case of Dick Grasso's pay, which raised the larger question of independence. I know that Bill Donaldson wrote a strongly worded letter on that. I'm not sure if that was considered to be in violation of rules or not, or if it was just not considered kosher, so to speak. Then, of course, there was the specialist front running, and then the even broader issue of the broker-analyst conflicts. I don't know if we would want to loop that into this discussion as well.
Yeah, the Dick Grasso item, just to begin there, you know, was a very interesting and perplexing item from various aspects. One, the New York Stock Exchange, and being its chair, had been viewed, I think I can safely say this, in the past, as being sort of a public service kind of an arrangement. Bill Donaldson himself
mm-hmm.
had been chair of the New York Stock Exchange, and he certainly viewed the time he was there not as a time to be the head of a public company where he could essentially legitimately get stock options, for example, or whatever. But the idea, he found it very difficult to accept the idea that someone being the chair of the New York Stock Exchange, given the premise that it was a utility, a public service kind of a situation, would make, you know, would be given $40 million or be compensated. You know, not saying he didn't deserve it. I'm just saying, you know, just the notion was foreign. And you know, he wrote a letter. I think the commission. We didn't have a particular enforcement matter because it was done in such a way where it didn't violate a rule, as I understand, maybe a spirit in the minds of many, but there was no violation per se. And so, you know, aside from our view that this was very bad form by an SRO, I don't think there was much more that we could do about it. Certainly, at the time, the Attorney General Elliot Spitzer brought an action, and he had an interesting theory, you know, civil theory about the appropriateness and the propriety of that particular amount. And frankly, I think the case was eventually dismissed and it died. And you know, DiGrasso kept his money, you know, in terms of what occurred. And again, you know, from a public perception, it just was very bad. It didn't look right. It looked like there was some self-dealing that went on. And this at the time, given the aftermath of the Enron scandals, was just not healthy, you know, for building public trust in the stock markets and you know, buying public company stock as a legitimate investment. So that occurred. Switching to another area, the broker analysts or the analyst scandal, which involved analysts privately saying to themselves, "This company," and I'm quoting here from one of the emails, "this company's a dog," mm-hmm. or words to that effect, and yet recommending it highly, you know, in their mm-hmm. public, you know, publications to shareholders. You know, it was a big item, and it caused friction. Harvey Pitt was still the chairman at the time, because what occurred is our OC, our Office of Compliance and Examinations, did not find this particular violation or this particular mm-hmm. existence of these conflicts, but instead. The Attorney General's office did, you know, and so they brought an action under the Martin Act. And so there was a contentious period between Harvey Pitt and on behalf of the SEC and the Attorney General's office in terms of who had jurisdiction. And yes, you know, the Attorney General, you know, had its own particular Martin Act and jurisdiction, but the SEC traditionally and through the federal authorities had oversight of analysts and that activity. So ultimately, it was a compromise, and both jurisdictions ended up bringing cases, and they settled, and they set up a situation in which the analysts and their firms, you know, agreed to build firewalls, and they agreed for a period of time to have an oversight monitor, you know, to make sure that conflicts did not arise, and that the independent, and that I'm sorry, that the those giving opinions and advice on particular stocks were not also on the selling team in some fashion, mm-hmm. so they wouldn't be compensated by whether their companies made lucrative sales to of services in one way or another to someone that whose stock they were touting. Mm-hmm. So that continued, and that was you know, that was a interesting time and got a lot of attention. You know,
and you're a critic of the settlement. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
I don't remember. I don't.
It didn't exercise you that greatly. That.
Well, you know, I felt. You know, I looked into it, in the ultimate settlement, as I recall, I felt. You know, was appropriate. I may have felt that there may, you know, more monetary sanctions should have applied, but you know, I think I ultimately did not. I ultimately approved or agreed in terms of a vote on the settlement that went past here.
Okay, So how involved was the commission with the creation of NYSE regulation?
We had at the time an NYSE regulation that oversaw the market activities. Mm-hmm. And then we had what was left of NASD, which, as you know, had evolved and developed the NASDAQ and spun the NASDAQ out. Mm-hmm. So we had an SRO embedded in the NYSE, and we had the NASD on its own with oversight responsibilities of the NASDAQ. And so the commission, together with the staff, determined that it would be more efficient to bring most of the New York regulatory aspects to combine it with the NASD into an independent organization, an SRO, enabling them to both oversee the NYSE, which kept some of its compliance functions internally, and the NASDAQ, and broker dealers, you know, and that came about. Mary Shapiro and Rick Ketchum were the two heads, Rick of the NYSE regulation, and Mary Shapiro was a co-head of the NASD.
Our NYSE regulation itself was only a few years old at this point.
So yes.
When it was decided to combine them.
Right.
Right.
Right, right. And this is what became FINRA. Mm-hmm. You know, they changed their name and so forth, and that's what we have today. Mostly it worked out pretty well. The members of NASD, which are brokers, had to agree, and NYSE had also, you know, and their board had to agree, and there was some trickiness there, but you know, with the urging of the SEC and the commission as a whole, this came to pass, and we felt that was an improvement, and you know, we have the aftermath today. We have a robust independent FINRA, and you know, they're looking to expand some of the things they do, mm-hmm. and that's the decision of the SEC now.
Okay. Making our way through our list of issues, there seem to be quite a lot of them in this period, but there's Reg NMS, after many, many years, finally gets going at this time. Can you talk a little bit about what motivated that push to get it through in the mid-2000s?
Well, there was a lot of concern, and there had been in prior years, you know, that the outcry system, in other words, the floor brokers, mm-hmm. They were called specialists at the NYSE, they were called floor brokers elsewhere, and some of the other. At one time, you had an Amex, you had an American Stock Exchange, you had a Philadelphia Stock mm-hmm. Exchange, you had a Boston Stock Exchange, you had a Pacific Stock Exchange, and we started getting electronic exchanges mm-hmm. that were coming in vogue. The NASDAQ pioneered, at least in the U.S., some of that because there were essentially a trader's desktop approach. And the concern of the staff and other critics, other academics, was that the floor brokers were able to benefit and a trade ahead of orders. You know, they had a peak, as it were, for a period of time. And if they were dealing with a stock, they could also do their own proprietary right. trading, you know, at, you know, and earn substantial returns at the expense of ordinary investors. You know, so the argument went. And Europe had started going this way anyway, you know, in terms of electronic markets and orders being put in, you know, from various sources, but electronically as opposed to on the floor and manually. So the staff had evolved to the point where they believed that a new system could be put in. And the idea was that the principal benefit would be that investors would get the best price, and no matter where it was, right? The idea was that, well, the way things were being transferred and passed on, if Joe X from, you know, from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, put in an order, he might end up at the NYSC, and the NYSC might execute it through the particular floor broker specialist that was assigned that stock, where there was a better price at the NASDAQ, who also, you know, quoted that particular stock or that particular share. Or maybe there was a better price, and, you know, when we began this in 02, 03, you know, we had many, many exchanges. They hadn't yet consolidated the way they have today. So that this was, you know, a eureka item. I mean, this was not a small thing. The idea that a small investor who didn't have any clout, who wasn't Goldman, who wasn't Merrill or some other large investment bank, could put it in, and their order would get the best price being quoted at that instant, you know, and it would be pinged around until it found the best price, you know, in a way that was fair and appropriate. That was very appealing to me and the other commissioners. It became no longer a matter of who you knew or did you know how to play the game, and you know, your particular broker has gotten in, quote unquote, with, you know, the floor brokers at a particular exchange or to get better treatment. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the major reforms that was very attractive. You know, along the way, part of NMS also involved decimalization, mm-hmm. which, you know, still controversial, but, you know, it reduced the spreads. You know, the spreads being where the intermediaries, the brokers, i.e., can make money. If it's smaller, they're just smaller nibbles that are available, you know, and by putting it in hundreds versus eighths, you mm-hmm. know, a fraction of a dollar, made it much smaller. And so that was, you know, the industry in many quarters didn't like that because that did squeeze their margins. What you were paying for market data, you know, the idea of making everything transparent, you know, mm-hmm. at least in equities, right? Putting up quotes where there was no secret quotes somewhere else being done was also attractive. And the idea that, you know, the best price would be available, you know, as we just discussed, but also it would be known, mm-hmm. you know, and that would be reported. So part of the one issue was to incentivize the markets to give up that data and put it in a consolidated tape, giving, you know, huge transparency that had never been there before. I'll note that in Europe you still don't have a consolidated tape. Mm-hmm. You know, you still have situations where, you know, there's a price, you know, in one market, you know, the Deutsche Börse, and there's another price at the LSE, you know, for the same security. You know, the quotes just are different. Mm-hmm. So that was another item. So all these reasons led me, and I looked at, you know, again, with other commissioners, everybody was making their own evaluations. Leaving it alone would have continued essentially an antiquated process, you mm-hmm. know, of the specialists and floor brokers, and continued a system in which retail investors were not getting their best price. Mm-hmm. When we looked at, you know, at the problems, what were the benefits versus the costs, there was some concern about connectivity and could the electronics handle it. But I was convinced, you know, that the technology existed and that everyone could be connected. That was initially a problem. Well, you know, you can't connect the Pacific Stock Exchange with, you know, with the brokers over here in the NYSE and or the NASDAQ. And if an order comes in, you know, how can it go around the block, you know, to find the best and be sent to the best place, you know, and what part of the book is going to be disclosed and all mm-hmm. of that. But, you know, we became convinced it could happen. It could do it. And the staff was very convinced that the electronics and the technology was up to snuff. Mm-hmm. to accomplish this. So, you know, when it came time and you know, and this was a year, almost 2 years of discussions, roundtables, the industry was coming in and lobbying for their view and so on. And, you know, and a lot of people were just lobbying to preserve their business models, obviously. So ultimately, we did pass it. It was contentious. I think it was a 3-2 vote. The again, Paul Atkins and Sidney Glassman, if I remember correctly, opposed it. Bill Donaldson, I think, was the chair at that moment, and he voted in favor of it along with Harvey Goldschmidt and I. And, again, the concerns was it was ambiguous and it would cause more harm than good. I think, the history has shown itself that NMS has been a very, very good thing, given the smaller spreads. The cost of executing orders in the U.S. is the lowest in the world, substantially. Retail investors find their best price. The recent controversy over high frequency trading, is fair. That was certainly not in our realm. That was not an item that no one had that kind of firepower to be able to use computers by a broker in that fashion to try to do what Flash Boys, that particular book, says is occurring today. So I believe that it's very appropriate to look at NMS again, but its basic principles should be maintained. I think there's ways to protect orders, get someone from getting a hint or a peek at orders before others do. Mm-hmm. That's always been an issue.
They're different generations of problems.
So exactly. If you go back far enough, you had a situation in Europe where fast horses, would take prices to, from one European city to the other and give a group of investors a heads up on the price before others would learn. Then they use pigeons, essentially. So we just have a variation of that problem now with high-frequency trading. Many high-frequency traders will tell you that they don't do that. What they really do is they do an algorithm that predicts where the pricing is going. So they're making a bet, right, that the price, given these conditions and what's occurring, the price is likely to go up or down, and they'll make a trade accordingly. And they tell me that if they're right 52 times out of 100, they're doing pretty well. So anyway, it's a fair area to look at to make sure that the public doesn't feel that there's an undue advantage to particular banks and brokers. But I think it can be well handled within the current technology and the current structure that we have.
And then there were the changes to the net capital rule in 2004. After the financial crisis, a lot of attention was put on those, perhaps in some cases misleadingly. But I'm wondering, at the time, was that viewed just basically as kind of a technical update, which is how I've read about it being in some areas. But I'm curious as to what your perspective on the discussions were at the time.
Well, they were controversial because they involved how much in reserves broker dealers needed to keep on hand to protect their broker and their broker clients in the event of a collapse of some sort, And so this is safety money essentially. Brokers felt they had enough, in general, that they had enough already, and the idea of raising the amounts and recalibrating them because of for more safety for broker clients, and also what you would count against reserves, right? There was always a tier one, a certain category of government securities were tier one, certain rated commercial bonds, and so forth were rated as tier one, and others less liquid in terms of the effort here, in terms of grading them, would not be considered or would be given a haircut, quote unquote, right? If you had grade B bonds, for example, I don't remember the formula, but they would be haircutted. In other words, they would only count in terms of a fraction against the required net capital amounts. And all these were discussed, and there was a lot of back and forth, and I have to say what occurred during my era was that the industry would come in, sometimes with lobbyists, and they would make a presentation to the staff, and they make a presentation individually to commissioners. We would learn about it, we would go back to the staff, talk about these issues. Are they right when they told me this such and such? We would ask some of our own internal experts. I would have my own staff do research. And in this way, we tried to get it right, in terms of the item, through the expertise internally at the SEC, through my own personal staff and through doing our own research at times. So, that's essentially what occurred, and we made changes, you know, on the net capital rules, and I think we haven't had very many broker-dealers fail, you know, as a result. Can I take a small break?
Absolutely.
You need to go to the restroom.
I want to ask, just to make sure we don't run out of time, this interview is being done as part of a series that's in support of a gallery that the Historical Society is putting together on the executive branch. And I imagine that you didn't have all that much contact with the executive branch, but I'm curious about the general signals coming from the Bush administration at this time, if any, with respect to the SEC, what those would have been perceived to be. It seems to me that there was a lot of emphasis on things like tax cuts and capital gains, which is, of course, tax policy, but... I don't know. Do you have a perspective on that?
You're right. I did not have any direct discussions any time when I was a commissioner with anyone from the executive branch anyway whatsoever. Now, there were always rumors, you know, and that... that certain Republican commissioners during the Bill Donaldson era were complaining about Bill Donaldson, and that Bill Donaldson didn't support the quote Republican views as tenaciously as he should, or something. Now, again, I always found that to be odd, because the work of the agency is not partisan, you know. It's not, you know, it's not a political item. You know, what you do, what you're supposed to do, is you all commissioners and the staff essentially make a pledge to the mission, which is to protect the integrity of the markets and to protect investors. And you know, you make calls that you know, may fall initially harder on a particular industry or a particular regulated industry or business. But I never viewed that as either a Republican or a Democratic item, right? If investors benefit and they get more clarity, more transparency, everybody benefits. If there's better governance in public companies, everybody benefits, right? NMS, you know, I didn't view it as partisan either. The choice, you know, we talked about this already, the choice of the chair of the PCAOB. I'm not even sure it's, well, I don't know. I don't know if people, if that's still viewed or that's still an issue with the commission and its recent appointments. It shouldn't be, and I hope it's not. You know, if there were discussions going, I don't have any idea whether the chairs, you know, who were all Republican at the time, you know, had a channel, you know, to the executive branch. You know, I don't know whether Harvey did. I don't know whether Bill Donaldson did. I don't know whether Chris Cox did. You know, I know they all took their, each of the chairmen I worked under was very serious about their obligations to the public investor.
I wanted to ask you about international issues as well, because I know you took a particular interest in this. In fact, from learning your speeches, I learned about the differences between convergence and equivalence and harmonization, maybe at the far horizon. I wonder if you could give me a few highlights of some of the issues that you worked on.
Sure. Well, I volunteered to be the agency's representative in international forums. And... at the time, you know, I went to Harvey Pitt with my willingness to do it. None of the other commissioners particularly wanted to do it, you know, because it involved a big commitment in time and, you know, and a lot of travel, right? Overseas travel. But I enjoyed it immensely, because essentially what we were doing was trying to find a way to, as we said, converge the different securities regulation regimes across the world, where, you know, something wrong in the U.S. would be wrong also in Europe and also in Asia or South America, you know, where there wouldn't be sort of a, you know, it's wrong only in America but not elsewhere, things like that. And I'll give an example. Insider trading, you know, as we know it today, very established concept, right? If an individual gets information from a so-called insider, usually an executive or member of a senior management team that knows about something that's material, that's about to occur. Could be announcing, you know, very good earnings, or it could be announcing losses. Anyway, if that information is conveyed, you know, by a tipper to a tippee, then, you know, you have a problem of insider trading. There's also recent cases where it's complicated, that say that there has to be a benefit to the tipper. But those concepts are not universal across the world, right? Even in London and in the UK, insider trading was viewed differently than in the US. And then recall that I started in 2002 and we immediately began implementing Sarbanes-Oxley. So the whole issue became, does Sarbanes-Oxley apply to other foreign jurisdictions outside the U.S.? And I'll give you an example. The PCAOB that we've talked about required its auditors, right, to register with the PCAOB if they audited a public company. And then by so registering with the PCAOB, they subjected themselves to oversight and to examination by the PCAOB. Well, you know, European auditors and their representatives and, you know, their regulators say, wait a minute, we oversee European auditors. You know, why? What gives you, America, you know, and the SEC, the right to, you know, require European auditors to register with the PCAOB? Well, we had a simple answer, you know. Well, some companies, you know, that are foreign, for example, Volkswagen, think of any large, or it could be small, European company or Asian company. Mm-hmm. If they want to sell their securities in the U.S., they have to register, you know, in the U.S., and they have to submit, you know, audited financials as part of our, you know, our system. And if auditors, you know, from other jurisdictions, other parts of the world, perform the audit, then, you know, we believe we had the right to review those. Now, the compromise that occurred was that those audits of auditors that audited companies that listed in the U.S. would be led and principally done by the local authorities, with the PCAOB being involved, you know, and watching, and, you know, whatever they had. That has evolved over time, you know, slowly. But essentially, it provides the sort of assurances that the PCAOB is looking for with the procedures that are done to examine foreign auditors that also have a large audit role in the companies that are listed in the U.S. that may be from other jurisdictions. So I had to face, you know, a lot of animosity initially, you know, and outrage. You know, you're trying to, you know, regulate us. You know, the SEC doesn't have the right. You know, the U.S., why is the U.S. passing these laws and so forth? Well, you know, it took a while, but, you know, they came to, I think, believe, you know, I'm talking now about my colleagues, mm-hmm. who are as securities regulators or other types of authorities in Europe and Asia and elsewhere, you know, that this was a reaction to try to improve things in the U.S. No one had thought too deeply about the fact that it might touch, you know, foreign auditors who are, mm-hmm. you know, who are scrutinized by other authorities and other regulators. Or even foreign lawyers, you know, who have something to do at times with the listings and the financial statements. So we that was a very interesting time in doing that. And one of my goals was to develop a more robust international regulatory community. It had been very – Arthur Levitt, during his time, did not do a lot with it. He was interested at one point, and then – and then the other larger priorities came to take his time. And so there had been some neglect. And I believe that the U.S. SEC, which was the predominant or the preeminent securities regulator in the world, being actively involved gave it new life and a new vigor and enabled you know, the organization to, you know, do meet a lot of its objectives. We wanted to have international security standards, for example, and we worked on those high level, you know, that were hopefully converging. We had the issues of the American gap, you know, FASB, mm-hmm. you know, U.S. gap, versus what became known as the International Accounting Standards, right, or IFRS, International Financial Reporting Standards. And those were different in many respects. You know, they allowed, you know, in some respects they were better, frankly. In other respects, they weren't as rigorous as U.S. GAAP. And so there's been an effort to converge those over the years. And it began strongly during the time that I was there. It's one of the things that I encouraged to occur.
The last big issue that I wanted to address, which is very controversial, was the shareholder access question.
That was always a big issue when I was there. I left in 07, so we had not yet passed a shareholder access. The idea, very briefly, is that shareholders of a public company, as a normal rule, are presented a company proxy mm-hmm. that has a slate of directors being nominated that the current board supports and management supports. So, you know, the concept is, well, should an investor somewhere in Peoria be allowed to nominate himself or his best friend or somebody, or maybe Warren Buffett, you know, somebody who's very accomplished as a director on that particular board? And there's no mechanism to do that very effectively. You know, a minority group of shareholders, and I say minority because of a majority, could all obviously change the board, you know, and they control enough shares to change the board on their own, just with their own votes. But a minority does not have the ability to very easily run a competing slate of directors. Let's say they hated all the directors and they want to run seven other people that they think would do a much far better job. Well, they have to get this slate and this information, this proxy, to all the other investors who are going to vote. And they don't have the list, and the process doesn't allow for this. So the concept in particular, many pension plans became very supportive of the idea. It would give them the ability to influence weak companies that they felt the boards were not active enough or, you know, making the right decision, changing management mm-hmm. or whatever they thought. Some activists thought about, you know, that this would also improve governance. So we debated this over and over, and we had several roundtables on the matter. And I remember convening a meeting over dinner of the business roundtable that very much opposed shareholder access, and many of the shareholder proponents of a new access system. You know, and I tried to see if there was a way to broker a deal, you know, make something happen. The view of the corporate community at the time was, well, you know, we have three Republican commissioners, and they're not going to vote for shareholder access. Mm-hmm. Again, this became viewed as a Republican and Democratic situation, which, again, I think is unfortunate because, you know, it's either stands on its own, you know, as a good governance principle, or it doesn't. Mm-hmm. In Europe, for example, in London, any shareholder can frankly call a meeting and call for a vote, you know, with the appropriate notice and all of this. You know, a far more robust system. The fact that it doesn't happen very often shows that, you know, there's some discipline in the system mm-hmm. and that, you know, people don't do it willy-nilly. So that was used often as, well, why would it shake things up so badly in the U.S.? So it was still being debated when I left in 07. The commission became very distracted in 08, of course, you know, with the meltdown that occurred. You know, finally, at the end of 08, of course, the new president, Barack Obama, was elected. He came in and appointed Mary Shapiro as the chair. And Mary Shapiro did have a form of shareholder access passed. And, you know, it was technical, you know, 5% or so. You know, you had to have a big enough shareholder block to propose it. There were other rules, you know, other rules had to be followed. You know, notice had to be given and so forth. But as you know, the this particular shareholder access rulemaking was also struck down by the D.C. Circuit, and it was opposed, and it was challenged on the same grounds that the administrative analysis of cost-benefit analysis was not done sufficiently. Mm-hmm. And again, it was a call, a judgment call, and Mary Shapiro as chair, and the staff chose not to, it was her call ultimately, they chose not to appeal it.
One issue that I wanted to very quickly touch on, I read somewhere that you were interested in it, at least early on, and I know that Mary Shapiro almost got SEC self-funding in that same period. Of course, that never came to pass. But I'm wondering if you have any insights on, whether or not that was ever prominent during your time there, approaching prominence.
Well, I supported it from the very beginning because it seemed very obvious to me that you've heard me say several times that the SEC should not be making decisions based on politics, right? I mean, I'll be saying for the Fed and for other major organizations that were essentially developed, remember, in the aftermath of the great Wall Street crash in 1929, right? And the idea was that you would create, and this was, the post, Franklin Roosevelt and the Congress and effort to create a system that had independent checks. So to me, the idea that the SEC every year had to go back on its knees and beg for its for resources enabled Congress to essentially starve the agency, if you will, if it chose to, in a fashion that would inhibit enforcement and inhibit other areas that a particular party or a group in Congress didn't like. Mm-hmm. So if they, for example, if this is not necessarily the case, but if they didn't like enforcement because they felt that the SEC was being too aggressive, and bringing too many cases, well, if they provided less resources for fewer lawyers and fewer trial aides and so forth, they could affect that particular part of what they did. Or examinations, let's say, if resources aren't sufficient, you can't examine broker-dealers or investment advisors as easily, which now include private equity. So I've always believed that it allowed for a potential influence that was based on politics because of Congress, because of the appropriation process. Mm-hmm. Now, the Fed has its own self-funding. They essentially get funded through levying fees on the board members, on the banks that are members, and so I believe that the SEC essentially through fees that could be paid in by those who are the biggest users of the regulator, the investment advisors, broker dealers, not to mention enforcement fees that went into a general pot. Could also be, subject to supporting, the SEC. And I pushed hard. I tried every way I could. I talked to the banking committee and its staff and others. And what I was told just very specifically was there was no way that at least the Republicans at that time in Congress would approve. They wanted very much to be able to control the purse strings of the SEC. It was giving up too much a power and authority, and so there was no hope, of my being able to go anywhere with it because the basic politics were such that it wasn't going to occur. Frankly, today is the same thing. There is no way, given the makeup of Congress, that would be approved.
Okay, well, I think I've brought you up to our time limit. It's 3:00 now, but if you have a quick word to say about your decision to leave in 2007, you weren't at the end of your term, right?
No, I still had 2 years. No, I decided it was time for me to go back into the private sector. Mm-hmm. I'd served 5 years, but I think I discharged myself with with a lot of competence, and I had. I felt good about what I had accomplished. There's always more, to be done. But I felt it was a good time to leave. I felt on the top of my game, and I was interested in again in going back into the private sector. If you add my years in public service, I'm almost at 20 years with my military service, with including my cadet time, with my period of being a federal prosecutor, and then my period as an SEC commissioner. So, you know, I felt it was appropriate for me to, you know, take on new challenges in the private sector.
Okay. Well, like I say, I'm conscious of the fact that you have other things to do, so I'll leave it there. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
No, my pleasure. And if you want to later, when you listen to it, and you, if you feel like there's augment, you want me to augment, I'm happy to do it. But, you know, we can set up other interviews or talk on the phone, whatever ends up being convenient.
Okay, I appreciate it.
You bet.